Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
You know, in all our programs, we're always trying to make them work better for producers.
Robert Bonney is USDA's Undersecretary for Farm Production and Conservation on the importance of crop insurance.
And in the case of crop insurance, it's through looking for ways to provide new products through our 508H process. It's looking for ways to expand opportunities like whole farm and micro farm that provide opportunities for specialty crop producers and others. So with everything we're doing, we're trying to open up the doors to make our crop, whether it's crop insurance or other safety net programs, available to as many types of producers to recognize the diversity of agriculture as we can. We think that remains important. And even with our ad hoc disaster programs, we structure them in a way to encourage folks to take advantage of whether it's NAP or crop insurance. So we think, again, crop insurance is absolutely vital.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
We could be innovative and creative enough to create additional profit opportunities from farms small, mid-sized, and large. New profit centers.
Ag Secretary Tom Vilsack on what the future of farming could be.
With the CCC, the Commodity Credit Corporation, we established the Climate Smart Agricultural Commodity Partnership Initiative. That's all about value-added agriculture. That's all about sustainable agricultural practices that the market values and benefits. Being able to tell their customers that what they're purchasing in terms of their food products have in fact been produced in a sustainable way. And there's a market value to that. So we have 141 projects that we're funding and providing resources to de-risk our farmers from embracing climate smart practices and then linking them to markets that value those climate smart practices and rewarding them. That's a new opportunity. It's similar to what we do with organic. And this administration has put more resources in allowing more farmers to transition. With American Rescue Plan resources, we've created an organic transition program, making it a little bit easier and a little less expensive for those who want to take advantage of that value-added opportunity. So that's a new profit opportunity. And as we embrace climate smart practices, we also create the opportunity for those same farms to generate another income opportunity through ecosystem service markets. There are 24 of these markets around the country today. They're just getting started. They're water markets. They're carbon markets, they're wildlife markets, they're biodiversity markets. They're markets in which farmers will be paid for the environmental result that they're able to obtain from sustainable practices. Because of the 141 projects that we're funding, we're going to use those resources to also monitor and measure and report and verify the results, which allows us to create a stronger and better market. And with the omnibus bill and the Climate Solutions Act that was included in the omnibus bill, we're required at USDA to begin that process of figuring out how to certify these market opportunities. So there's a new opportunity, a new income source, a new revenue stream for our farmers. So it's not just climate smart agriculture. It's also understanding and appreciating that we've consolidated not just farming operations, but we've also consolidated the processing world, which limits the markets, and in some cases there is no market, or in some cases there's a single market, and farmers are only able to take whatever the price is at that particular moment from that one single market. And so the President has instructed us to expand market opportunities, to invest in processing. So the first thing we did was to provide resources to existing facilities that were currently selling in their own specific state, and allowing them to sell across state lines. Expanding a market, new and better markets. And we've recently, this week, announced an additional 5 investments for new and expanded processing capacity funded by the American Rescue Plan. We've now identified 30 different processing opportunities for meat, poultry, and pork. The opportunity for us to expand across the country new processing capacity. So this is nearly 300 opportunities that we've currently invested in, and we're not stopping. There'll be more investments for expanded processing capacity. And we'll also figure out a way to utilize resources from the American Rescue Plan, not only to focus on beef and pork and poultry, but also to expand to all opportunities for additional commodities, for additional processing, for what we refer to as competitive foods. An opportunity for specialty crops that require additional processing opportunity to also benefit from this new and expanded market opportunity. Yet another profit opportunity.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
So our fiscal year starts at the beginning of October, so we've just finished our first quarter. But this meeting is very important for us because, like I said, these contractors are coming out here, and they're giving updates to all our producers about these programs that are checkoff funded.
Greg Haynes is the CEO of the Cattlemen's Beef Board, speaking earlier this year at the Cattle Industry Convention.
So our board, we have 101 board members. Every one of our of these board members is on a program committee. There are six committees. So there's CBB members, also Federation members. So each of these committees has about 80 or about 40 people actually on them, you know, producers that are looking at this. So the contractors are giving those producers updates and talking about, you know, where the programs are going. But this is the opportunity for the producers to also give that feedback to the contractors. As they hear this, they can talk about what they like, or have you guys thought about this, or what about this? And so that helps kind of direct the contractors where they need to go and kind of enhance and continue to move these programs. So this is a super important meeting for that. There's another meeting we'll have in the summer, very similar, and that's where the contractors will bring kind of their final proposals for 2024. But again, all the producers on these committees are giving that feedback. So it's an important process to ensure, you know, the producers are engaged, involved in this. Our board, like I said, 101 people are from all over the country. So the feedback they're getting is very broad and very representative of the industry. So I think that helps really ensure that the programs are doing what they're supposed to do and meeting the demands of the producers.
Over the past week, a couple of amendments from the House that would gut checkoff programs. But Haynes says,
I think evaluation is incredibly important. You know, we need to show to the producers or who are paying into this that these programs are having an impact. We're not just doing stuff to do it. And so we have a very active evaluation committee. And so every program that's out there has to report back quarterly on set goals and targets that they had set originally when that activity was approved. So they're reporting back on that, and we're tracking that quarterly, and we come out with an annual report too. And that annual report we just actually released 2 days ago. So that's on our website if anybody wants to see it. It's pretty easy to read, but it gives you really a lot of great detail on the impact that these various programs are having. We do that, but another thing that we just started a couple years ago, we call these third-party independent analysis. And so we've hired an outside contractor to come in, and each year we select just a handful of programs, and we do a deeper dive into them. And so the goal here is to look at the programs, like what's working, maybe what's not working. You know, are there other things that we could be doing to enhance this? And so we're not trying to, you know, criticize the contractors or whatever, but I think anytime you have, you know, an outside set of eyes looking at something, it may spur some, you know, some new concepts or different things you can be doing. So our goal with this is just to really drive that continuous improvement, get the biggest impact we can have for every checkoff dollar that we're collecting, and, you know, really get that bang for the buck and create that demand for beef. So all those have been set up to do that. Again, it's very transparent. Our producers can see what's happening with that. And then we also do another return on investment study every 5 years. So we had one done in 2020. We're going to start the next one in 2024. But the impact of that has always been good. You know, the last one showed that for every dollar we're investing, we're really getting $12 back of impact to the industry. And that's pretty significant. So I think all this really shows that the checkoff's heading in the right direction and having an impact on that consumer demand.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
I'm concerned about this administration's lack of attention.
South Dakota Senator John Thune talking to Alexis Taylor from USDA at a recent Senate Ag Committee hearing.
To expanding market access for U.S. agricultural products, I hope you and your and USTR Ag Chief and Chief Negotiator McKellop's recent confirmations are a turning point for this administration when it comes to ag trade. In your new role, what are some specific, new ideas? And in addition to maintaining existing access to corn exports to Mexico, what are your ideas on new market access opportunities for U.S. farmers and ranchers? And is the administration considering market access opportunities in Africa? And then finally, are you advocating for reauthorization of trade promotion authority?
So I think, first and foremost, one of the areas that is a priority for me coming into this role is looking at market diversification. Obviously, the People's Republic of China is our largest single agricultural market, but we all saw what an over-reliance on any single market can mean. So looking to help our agricultural exporters, our farmers and ranchers, identify new markets is really critical. I look to a couple different regions of the world first. I think South Asia is a really exciting opportunity. I think about countries like Vietnam, when they have some of the highest macroeconomic growth projected in Asia. They also have an expected 5 million middle-class households going to come online in the next 5 years. So we have an opportunity today and early on to create consumers, lifelong consumers. Their population is also relatively young, so lifelong consumers of American agricultural products. I think there's a lot of potential and exciting opportunity there. One that while the Indo-Pacific economic framework is still getting underdeveloped and exactly what the outcomes might be for U.S. agriculture, but I am hopeful that we will see successful access there, addressing SPS and non-tariff barriers to knock down some trade hurdles that we currently experience. Likewise, you mentioned Africa. I think Africa is generally has a lot of potential. Specifically, I think Kenya is a very exciting potential market, which obviously we are engaging with there as well. We're also engaging in a couple other areas within the African continent. We are working with the African Continental Free Trade Area that is under negotiation there. But one of the areas that we are providing support is technical support, in particular as they are addressing SPS regulations and how science-based principles can really help form that continental trade agreement. And the U.S. is providing that technical support, which will also benefit our agricultural producers. So I think there is a significant opportunity on the African continent as well.
Let me just say, and again, with by way of IPEF, and I couldn't agree more that the way to isolate China is to do it economically, and that has obviously in that region of the world a lot of national security implications as well. And it just seems like IPEF didn't address the issue of market access, which is what our agricultural producers in South Dakota are looking for. And, you know, free trade agreements with countries in that region of the world, you know, free trade agreements with other places around the world, some that are kind of what we think are low-hanging fruit. And so it just seems like the administration, no request for trade promotion authority, hasn't been an FTA done, and the issue or the times there have been at least any sort of discussion around this issue, it's been related to issues on that don't have anything to do with market access. So I'm just saying, you guys got to step up your game here, and I hope you will.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
What we've seen over the last couple years is big increases in both imports and exports of agricultural products in the United States.
Dr. Seth Meyer is USDA's chief economist earlier this year, looking at ag trade.
When we think about our exports, and you saw it was dipping a little bit year over year into 2023, and it's pretty evenly spread. You can't pin it on one individual commodity. It's pretty evenly spread across grains and oil seeds, livestock and dairy, horticultural products, all of them coming down a little bit in volume and a little bit in price, so it's not one or the other. But when one looks out at FY23, kind of pulling back a little bit on exports, but still the second highest export total on record. China remains our number one customer. China came back into our market strongly. Remember I said, hey, prices began to rise in 2020? Part of that was a result of China coming back into our market strongly. They remain our number one customer, important customer. And Mexico ends up being number two, but Canada, a very close number three for 2023 is anticipated. One of the things affecting our exports, again, is, you know, this graph shows you energy price movements, ag price movements, and the strength of the U.S. dollar. You have seen energy prices begin to recede. You have seen ag prices start to fall. You've seen the dollar remain relatively strong. That does produce some headwinds for us when we think about exports. Those commodities are priced in dollars. The dollar is expensive. It makes folks wanting to buy commodities from us, makes it a little more expensive. So you can observe that within, you know, the export market. But on the other side of that, the strong dollar makes U.S. consumers able to import certain ag products that they like, okay? So when we think about a very strong import number, It's been largely driven by horticultural products over the last decade. Horticultural products have largely driven what are imported agricultural products. And you see, I break it down here into vegetables and fruits and preparations and then other horticulture. And then I further break those other horticultural products out. And when you look at this, you get a sense of, you know, this isn't a basket of a whole bunch of commodities that compete directly with U.S. agricultural products. There are some, but you have some of those vegetables and fruits which come in counter-seasonally, right? We aren't producing it at this time. It comes in counter-seasonally and makes it available at those times. Some of them are preparations, like miscellaneous horticultural products would be inputs or ingredients into some other product, added U.S. ingredients, and then produced within the United States. And then clearly some of the things like distilled spirits are folks making diet, if you want to call consuming beer and alcohol diet. It's part of your diet and you're making diversified choices in doing so, right? So I think that it is an interesting process by which the strong dollar provides some of those consumers some opportunities to kind of get some variation in there as well, too. If we see the dollar weaken a little bit, we may see a little bit of rebalancing between our exports and our imports. So let's talk a little bit about farm income. And when I think about farm income, again, I'll get you to the punchline here at the end, being that 2022 was a really great year. 2022 was a really great year for farm income. Okay? Got there with a lot of anxiety. Remember, I told you we had incredible volatility on both input prices and output prices. And so, you know, when you talk to producers, that's a lot of anxiety. Where are we going to end up? Okay? When we look forward into receipts in the coming year, those lower commodity prices are going to produce lower receipts across the board. But they're coming off of what are pretty high receipts. Okay? So you had pretty high receipts for all those commodities. In almost all cases for crops and livestock, you're seeing that recede a little bit.
Myers speaking earlier this year at the 99th Annual Ag Outlook Forum. It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
Through my decade of service to USDA and now seeing impacts from the pandemic and more frequent and intense natural disasters, I've gained a much deeper understanding of the challenges our producers face and the ways our safety net programs are instrumental in keeping families on the land and helping them build more resilient operations.
Robert Bonney is the Undersecretary for Farm Production and Conservation at USDA.
At FPAC, I have the honor to work with USDA's producer-facing agencies as we partner with farmers, ranchers, and forest owners to strengthen American agriculture and forestry. All four FPAC agencies, FSA, RMA, NRCS, and the FPAC Business Center, are engaging producers in new and more effective ways, streamlining program delivery, opening the doors of agriculture to all, and providing a more effective and holistic farm safety net. Since 2021, this administration has delivered pandemic assistance through CFAP and other programs in a way that provides invaluable assistance to producers while expanding the number of customers able to access aid. This approach and our other to CFAP and our other programs has meant we are reaching an estimated 50,000 more customers per year as compared to pre-pandemic levels. To expedite the distribution of the $10 billion in emergency relief funds provided by Congress in 2021, FSA and RMA leveraged existing data to streamline the application process and get money to producers faster than previous ad hoc programs. By year's end, FSA had processed more than 350,000 applications, totaling over $8 billion in payments to livestock, commodity, and specialty crop producers to help offset eligible losses from 2020 and 2021. We estimate that the design of the Emergency Relief Program and the Emergency Livestock Relief Program saved over 1 million hours of staff time and equally significant time for producers as well. The 2023 omnibus provided direction to FPAC to assist rice producers impacted by high input costs. FSA and RMA are working to build on our experience from the emergency relief we provided in 2022 to create a process that will be easy for producers and our staff. The omnibus also provided funds for broader ad hoc disaster payments. While we are thankful for what Congress has provided, the funding provided won't allow us to provide a comparable level of relief for producers with 2022 losses as compared to those impacted by 2021 and 2020 losses. Even with these ad hoc programs, I want to also reiterate that crop insurance remains a critical, a vital risk management tool for our producers. RMA is expanding coverage to more crops and producers than ever before. RMA's whole farm and microfarm policies are providing new opportunities for diversified producers and small-scale operators. For the livestock sector, the pasture, rangeland, and forage program now covers more than 250 million acres. USDA has also taken significant steps to support producers who rely on our farm loans. Thanks to passage of the Inflation Reduction Act, FSA was able to provide once-in-a-generation assistance to keep many of our borrowers in business. Approximately 11,000 delinquent direct and guaranteed borrowers had their accounts brought current with USDA's announcement in October. USDA also paid the next scheduled annual installment for qualified direct loan borrowers, giving them peace of mind in the near term, while Administrator Ducheneau and the FSA team consider other options to fully leverage the remaining assistance made available by Congress.
Robert Bonney is Undersecretary for Farm Production and Conservation at USDA. It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
We're looking at climate neutrality in beef and dairy. Climate neutrality is that point where we are no longer adding warming to the climate.
On Repairing the Narrative Around Livestock and Climate, Joe Proudman, Associate Director of Communications at the CLEAR Center at UC Davis.
It's significant for our sector because at the end of the day, methane is our Achilles heel, right? Methane is a strong, potent gas that has a very, very short lifespan, much different than carbon dioxide. In fact, almost complete opposites, right? Not as powerful. Methane is 28 more times powerful, but has a much longer lifespan. All the carbon dioxide that we emit today will be here for generations, thousands of years. Because of that, though, and you hear this a lot, methane is our quickest tool to reduce emissions, to reduce temperatures, or to slow climate change, is because it is that short lifespan that does it. And we get to that point, if we have constant emissions, say you don't grow your herd size, we will not be adding additional warming to the atmosphere. It's a very, very rudimentary explanation of it. But generally, that's what we're talking about. The key is, though, if you reduce it, then we have really good things. Only two sectors can pull carbon out of the atmosphere. That is agriculture and forestry. So the opportunity that we have to do that is immense, and to be part of a climate solution. So we really do talk about climate neutrality. When somebody talks about carbon neutrality, they're essentially talking about the same thing, right? If your primary greenhouse gas you emit is carbon dioxide, you get to zero emissions, or you balance that out, you're at climate neutrality. So it's analogous. We talk a lot about dairy digesters. I'm going to show you a research paper we just did around that. We look at feed additives. In those bubbles, we'll often look at additives. So like say we're feeding them, maybe like agolin or something like that, you know, where we're seeing how much methane they can reduce. We look at, I mentioned we had protein intake. We did a recent trial with Cargill on that. And then we're looking at how we measure methane emissions. Right now, you know, GWP 100 is kind of the standard. It'll continue to be the standard, but it doesn't always account for methane's short lifespan and the consequences of that. So we talk a lot about GWP star, which is just another matrix, another way to measure how methane emissions are impacting our climate. This white paper just came out, and this white paper was written, we called it the Three Amigos paper, because it was written with Dr. Frank Mittlener, Dr. Hermes Cabreab, and Dr. Daniel Sumner. These are three of the leading scientists in this field. Frank and Hermes looking at how we're reducing emissions in animals, and Dan looking at the economics around agriculture and livestock. We presented this paper to the California Air Resources Board, the California Department of Food and Agriculture, the CDFA, and also the California EPA the other day, just to talk about, hey, what we're doing in the dairy sector, the emissions we're reducing, and how we're doing it, it's working. And we will meet state goals by 2030 if we continue to aggressively mitigate and incentivize these mitigations. And of course, right now I'm talking about digesters, right, on the dairy side. Digesters have been an immensely powerful tool for us at the end of the day to reduce emissions. Farmers have an income, but we've also reduced 30% of our goal so far. One thing we know is that goal, that number, that 30%, it doesn't account for all the digesters we have. We're probably much, much further along there. We further talk about the need to tackle enteric emissions and how if we really still want to reduce emissions, incentivizing those will be beneficial. Of all the California climate investments the state has invested in, they've invested only 2% of those dollars to digesters and alternative manure management programs, but those have reduced 30% of the emissions in that program. By far, the most effective use of funds in that program so far. So we try to be the conveners, between academics, the industry, regulators, and whoever else, and consumers as well.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
These programs are voluntarily created by producers for producers, and they receive no taxpayer dollars for any of their activities or for USDA oversight of their activities.
Chairman of the House Ag Committee, G.T. Thompson, supporting checkoffs last week at 2 a.m. on the House floor.
Now, I'm a strong supporter of research and promotion programs and will wholeheartedly advocate for their continued existence. I believe any debate surrounding the integrity of these programs should be reserved for farm bill deliberations due to the fact that no dollars from the bill that is up for consideration that we are talking about funds these programs. I look forward to engaging with my colleagues to explain the merits and the mechanics of checkoffs and encourage anyone who has questions about these programs to engage with their producers to hear firsthand about the benefits of these programs.